Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now set. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, today the court has five causes consolidated into four oral arguments. In the order in which these will be submitted, they are Donald J. Willey versus Coastal States Management Company from Harris County, Jorge Trevino, M.D. versus Gennardo Ortega from Hidalgo County, which will be consolidated for oral argument with James Milton Malone and others versus Christopher Foster, M.D. from Dallas County, City of Odessa versus William G. Barton from Ector County, and Appraisal Review Board of Galveston County and others versus Tex Air Helicopters from Galveston County. In all of these causes, except the consolidated matter, each side has been allotted 20 minutes for arguments. In the consolidated matter, we've allotted 25 minutes per side. The petitioner may reserve a portion of the time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are all being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of the arguments by making application in the clerk's office. We will take a recess in between each argument, and we'll take a lunch recess before the final argument. The court is now ready to hear from petitioners in Willey versus Coastal States.
May it please the court. Mr. Michael Maness will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Each of the three questions on which the court has granted review in this case ultimately entails the decision on whether or not the obligation of the attorney to preserve the confidence and secrecy of the attorney's client foreclosed the attorney's assertion of a Sabine Pilot claim against a former employer who has allegedly fired the attorney solely because the attorney is refusal to abide by criminal law.
You say allegedly fired, but jury held a hell against you, so he was fired because...
No question. No question. We won on that.
Let me ask you this. The way the issues have been framed by you, and it seems also by the Court of Appeals, and it seems there has been no counter-contention against this, is that there is a presumption, a conclusion, this type of claim can exist in the attorney-client relationship, as opposed to what the wording of the Sabine case was, which was an employer-employee relationship. Is that even an issue that we can address in this case because of the posture of how you cast your points there and the way the response was?
Probably not. I'd like to say that Judge Davis, before we tried this case, said and denied Coastal's motion for summary judgment. I view this matter as a case in which there is a dual relationship. There is an employer-employee relationship. There is an attorney-client relationship. And I, as a trial judge, am only going to try the issues associated with the employer-employee relationship. The reason we cast the issues as we did in our application to Rivera is because we were quite surprised that the Court of Appeals elected to accept our argument attorney can sue under the Sabine Pilot Doctrine in a case such as this, but qualify that holding by saying, in the facts and circumstances of this case, Willie could not have proven his Sabine Pilot claim without violating the attorney-client privilege. That was something that we weren't ready for. When we filed our motion for rehearing, we specifically pointed out to the Court of Appeals panel that decided this case that Rule 503 the Texas Rules of Civil Evidence specifically says, and I think I'm quoting Rule now, there is no privilege with respect, and I'd like to read the rule because it's brief. There is no privilege under this rule, subdivision
Thank you.
There is no privilege under this rule, subdivision D, for subdivision 3, breach of duty by lawyer or client, as to a communication relevant to an issue of breach of duty by the lawyer to his client or by the client to his lawyer. So our position in court of appeals at the time we filed our motion for rehearing was, wait a minute, the court has erred in concluding that there's an attorney-client privilege issue of an evidentiary nature involved in this case because Rule 503 specifically says there is not. We were also surprised to see the Court of Appeals rely upon a superseded provision of the disciplinary rule and to use as the rule of decision an ethical precept that had existed at the time the petition was filed in the district court in 1984, but that did not exist at the time of trial in 1994.
What's your authority for argument that the 105 should have been applied rather than the court?
Well, essentially, Your Honor, our authority, I don't believe there are any cases that deal specifically with whether or not of the rule of decision applicable at the inception of the case rather than at the time the trial should apply. But there's ample authority in our present Texas disciplinary rule for professional conduct for a much broader proposition, and that is disciplinary rules, what we used to call the canons of ethics, used to call rules of disciplinary conduct, don't provide rules of decision in civil cases in Texas. Present section 9 of the Texas
But in this case, the party tried it on the basis that those rules applied.
I'm not sure that they did. I'm not sure at all.
Somebody objected to it.
No. I don't believe it was. I think Coastal consistently has maintained that an attorney-client privilege forecloses with a
and all on the issue of applying the rules to the case.
Yes.
Plus, the next step where you were, that the court erred in not using 105 instead of 4.
Right.
Well, if I recall, the suit was filed in 1985.
It was.
It wasn't tried until 1991.
No, it wasn't tried until 1991.
So where is your argument if you really got high behind and tried the case in 1988? Before the rule was passed.
Well, I think we're in essentially the same position because there's no dispute that Rule 503 of the Rules of Civil Evidence was enacted 1 month before Willie was fired.
So what happens to your argument about
the ethical consideration? Yes. Our position would be, in any event, the ethical rule, whatever version we use, don't provide a rule of decision for determining whether evidence is admitted or excluded in a civil case in Texas. I wanted to point out that the present disciplinary rules of professional conduct contain a preamble. I'm quite honestly not certain whether the preamble is to be regarded as a prescriptive rule of law, but in the preamble, paragraph 15, and I take it the Supreme Court of Texas approved these rules, the preamble specifically says, these rules are not designed to be standards for procedural decisions. Furthermore, the purpose of these rules can be abused when they are invoked by opposing parties as procedural weapons. The fact that a rule is a just basis for a lawyer's self-assessment or for sanctioning a lawyer under the administration of a disciplinary authority does not imply that an antagonist in a collateral proceeding or transaction has standing to seek enforcement of the rule. Now, I read that language clearly and unequivocally in stating you don't use the disciplinary rule as a basis for deciding whether evidence is or is not admitted in a civil case in Texas.
Surely a client can complain.
Sure.
That confidence is being betrayed, whether it's in litigation or anything else.
No question. Then I thank you, Your Honor.
So the plaintiff just stands to the discipline and gets his evidence admitted.
I think that could be true, except for Rule 503 is unequivocal. Rule 503 says there is no privilege. It fascinates me that we used to take clear and unequivocal language as lawyers and judges and try to interpret it in a way to fit it into different conceptual categories. Seems to me over my life as a lawyer in the last 29 years, we've now reached a point, certainly the present Supreme Court of the United States has reached the point where we generally adopt a position if the language of a statute or a rule or a prescriptive standard for deciding the case is clear and unambiguous, then we follow that language. We don't need to interpret it. We don't need to weigh competing policy considerations. The green brief, the amicus brief, fascinating, because it says that it involves great issues of public importance that involve, of course, weighing competing considerations of employers and employees. Our response is no, it doesn't. It involves simply reading the rules. If you read the rules, it's quite clear that an attorney who is wronged by a former employer may use what might otherwise be arguably privileged or confidential communications to prove his claim. And if the argument is, well, unscrupulous lawyers, they, after being fired, may use such confidentiality in an irresponsible manner to provoke a settlement, and that's the substance of this little green brief. Our response is, how about the irresponsible employers who attempt to enlist the assistance of attorneys to promote criminal acts and to evade their responsibilities to society generally?
I want to ask you about that latter part. Is there any evidence in the record, I think it's called the Belcher or Belcher Report, that that was going to be disseminated to the public or given to a governmental agency?
No, there was not. In fact, I believe the record is quite clear that the Belcher Report was what is called an internal environmental audit. It was designed essentially for the purpose of first determining whether the Belcher facilities were in compliance.
How was the Belcher Report going to be used then to further a crime or fraud on the government?
Well, the Belcher Report was evidence of we believe, Coastal's efforts to use Willie to further criminal activity because, as Willie testified at the trial, the preparation of the Belcher Report, and he did it, noted significant ongoing violations of law.
What were the criminal activities that he was asked to perform?
To change the Belcher Report as a mechanism or a means to allow the Belcher corporate hierarchy to claim that they were in compliance with federal and state environmental laws.
But they weren't going to use that.
They weren't going to utilize the report, but they were going to actually utilize Willie's professional skills and efforts as an attorney to tell them on the record within the corporation, you're okay, you're in compliance.
So there was evidence that they were going to say, we've got advice of counsel that says we're in compliance.
There's ample evidence in the record that that's the way the Coastal Corporation operates. That's the way the Coastal Corporation does it. In fact, you can take that to the bank. Absolutely. This $8.5 billion corporation that the evidence of trial showed consistently and repeatedly attempted to evade its responsibility under the environmental law. Just replete with evidence that this corporation complies with the law when it wants to. When it doesn't want to, it hires a staff of very capable lawyers to fence them and box and fiddle around with state and federal regulatory authorities. And of course, that's what we think is ultimately cause of the prompt of Willie's firing. Willie was the kind of lawyer who said, I'm not going to be a part of it. Our position, we think, is relatively straightforward. This case involves a simple evidentiary issue. We think we win on that proposition that the court should remand the case.
Does the record indicate anywhere what particular criminal statute was violated as a result of this request?
It does, Your Honor.
Does the report be changed?
Your Honor, it does. There's a footnote in our brief that sets forth.
But does the trial court record reflect that?
I believe it does. Judge Jacobson, as a matter of fact, asked for a memorandum on that issue right before, as I recall, right before the case was submitted to the jury, and I hope that memorandum is in the record. But that was a concern that he raised. He said he asked specifically what statute, state or federal, would Willie have violated on this record had he complied with Coastal's request to change the bill. That should be.
And there is a statute that indicates that had he taken the act of changing an internal memorandum that was not intended for public disclosure, not intended to be filed, with any agency, that in and of itself would constitute a crime.
I'm not sure that there's any specific statute that would condemn changing an internal environmental audit.
Well, that's what he was being asked to do.
Yes, that's what he was being asked to do. But that's in the same sense that there may not be any specific criminal statute that condemns having a couple of telephone conversations about not telling the truth to the Environmental Protection Agency. It's the scheme, it's the design, the fabric that woven together makes what we generally call a criminal conspiracy under Title 18, Section 2.
So the statutes that he is claiming would be violated are, in fact, the environmental regulation statutes?
All federal criminal statutes under the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. We cited those in our briefing.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court. Mr. Stan Crawford will present argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Stan Crawford, in-house counsel for Coastal States Management Company. Contrary to the assertions by petitioner's counsel, this case does involve significant elements of far-reaching public policy. This case is about whether different standards of ethical conduct should be applied to in-house or outside counsel, whether in-house counsel should be excused from protecting privileged information to the same extent that all other attorneys must if they wish to practice law in this state. Coastal would show that there should not be an ethical standard that is different and lower for a lawyer who also happens to be employed by a company.
This Why case do you is not, about, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead and don't.
Excuse me, Ron. It's
my reading that you have not raised as an issue here whether Sabine Pilot should apply to the attorney-client relationship. Do you concede that it should?
Your Honor, we specifically argued by our first point of error to the Court of Appeals that the nature of the attorney-client relationship precludes the extension of Sabine Pilot to the attorney-client relationship. Absolutely. The Court of Appeals did not adopt that argument, although they granted our first point of error, they adopted a second, more moderate position. But we did make the argument to the Court of Appeals, and it was preserved on appeal to that court. I don't believe we specifically reviewed that briefing by reply point to this court, but I still think this court, since it has the discretion to decide in a judicially created exception to the at-will doctrine, you know, how far the extension should apply, I think this court clearly has the discretion to define or to decide that no extension is warranted. So I think this court clearly can reach that issue.
Okay.
This case also is about what rule Texas will follow in permitting in-house counsel to sue for wrongful termination. Affirming the Court of Appeals holding would be an adoption of the more moderate approach that the state of California adopted in the General Dynamics case versus Superior Court, and it is the better rule if this court should decide that the cause of action should be extended to attorneys at all, which I do not think this court has to do. Finally, this case is about the damage that will be done to the consultation that goes on a daily basis between companies and their in-house counsel. If, in fact, clients do not know that the communications that they have will be privileged in the future, in the event an in-house attorney is discharged for some reason and decides to claim that was because he gave advice that wasn't followed, really internally.
Mr. Crawford, does a client, accepting for the moment that whatever is decided in this case ought to apply to all attorney-client privileges, I mean, attorney-client relationships, not just, you know, a particular in-house counsel circumstance, what client would be entitled to expect their communication to be privileged if they're attempting to order an attorney to break the law?
Your Honor, if an attorney is ordered to break the law, there are exceptions to confidentiality that are set out in the disciplinary rules. And the rules clearly provide that a lawyer must, if in order to prevent future crime or fraud, it involves great risk of personal injury, he must disclose. So the client has no right to expect confidentiality. And there are other exceptions.
No, that's a circumstance where it comes to the attorney's attention that the client might commit a crime in the future, then the attorney must disclose. Now, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what client reasonably expects to have his or her communication to the lawyer protected when the client is ordering the lawyer to commit a crime.
Okay. I think if the lawyer is ordering the attorney to commit a crime and the lawyer takes steps under the rules to disclose that, the client has no right to expect that it to be privileged.
But in the Sabine Pilot case, the circumstance there was the employee was ordered to do something that was a crime and so excluded. So why isn't an attorney, why under circumstances as it exists now, an attorney not able to disclose circumstances about being ordered to do a crime? It's
to being pilot or employment context or to the police or whatever?
Well, in the first place, Your Honor, the attorney-client relationship is not a standard employer-employee relationship. It has protections of confidentiality and privilege that go far beyond the normal employment relationship. In the second place, if you're talking about the facts in this case, as a matter of law, the changes that Mr. Willie was requested to make in the Belcher report, which is in the record as Exhibit 30, do not, as a matter of law, and could not, under any foreseeable analysis, require him to commit a crime. There simply is no crime that he was ordered to commit in this case. If you look at the record...
You try to convince the jury of that, but they didn't buy your argument.
Your Honor, the question of whether or not Mr. Willie was discharged for what is truly an illegal act is an issue of law for the court.
It was a fact issue.
The jury was asked whether it's the only issue, but they were not asked to make the decision of law as to whether or not he did, in fact, he was requested to do something that was illegal. That was assumed to be the issue after the trial court had passed on the issue, and I think incorrectly.
Has that issue been perfected here?
Yes, it has.
It's certainly not one of the points there brought by the petitioner. Where has it been perfected?
The argument is made in the reply, I believe it's made in the reply brief, and I know it was made thoroughly before the Court of Appeals. We argued at length that if, in fact, the cause of action was extended, and if, in fact, our objection to the use of privileged information was not sustained, then, as a matter of law, alternatively, the changing of the Belcher report could not have subjected Mr. Willie to criminal liability, and therefore, it could not be the basis for a cause of action that should be entitled, even if that cause of action was extended to his status. Never answered your question.
Well, you have. You told me what you raised in the Court of Appeals, but you haven't told me how it's raised here in the Supreme Court.
Your Honor, I think it was raised. I think it is in the briefing as to whether or not it could be considered unlawful. And certainly in prayer, we have requested that if this court should not affirm on the ground that the Court of Appeals decided, we should then, I think, can go ahead and reach the point of illegality. At the very least, this court could demand the Court of Appeals for consideration of that point, which it did not reach, but I think this court has the authority to reach the point. This case involves an in-house attorney who refused the request of his superior to make what are editorial changes to the tone of the document that is attached as Exhibit 30. I would invite all of you to look at the Belcher report, which is in evidence. The changes that were requested are noted in handwritten notations in the document. It is completely wrong when Mr. Willie claims that if he had made the changes that are requested, the company would have been given no notice that it had environmental deficiencies that needed to be corrected. What were requested by his superior, Mr. Clint Fawcett, in the legal department, were changes to the document to change its tone, to reduce its hectoring and its badgering of management, and its sort of condemnation of past management practices. But the substance of what needed to be changed, the permits that were needed, and the things the company needed to be done, are all still in the report. The only changes that were requested were internal changes solely going to tone. Now, there is a reason for that. Mr. Fawcett testified in the testimony below that when he originally received a request from Mr. Al Smith for an audit of what Belcher needed to do in order to comply with the environmental laws, he put together a team, and one of the members of the team was Mr. Donald Willie. And Mr. Smith told him he didn't want Mr. Willie involved because he didn't trust his judgment. He didn't want him involved in the audit. And Mr. Fawcett said, no, he'll do a good job for you. He's a good environmental lawyer. But the record also shows in the lower court that Mr. Willie, although he was concededly a good environmental lawyer, had a tendency to be stubborn, to insist on his own advice, to the detriment of listening to anyone else's point of view. He had a tendency to hector management and to stick his nose into matters that were not his concern. And I think all of these went into the considerations that Mr. Fawcett employed when he asked Mr. Willie to make some changes to the tone of the original report.
But that's either, I think we're digressing, you don't really, your main point of being here is that Sabine Pilot, the notion of Sabine Pilot in the employer-employee relationship regarding in-house counsel doesn't apply because the in-house counsel has an attorney-client privilege that they cannot avoid, even if the nature of the conversation is to order the attorney to commit a crime. That's the first point that Coastal's trying to make here.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Now, your second point is, if we decide that an employer can't order the attorney to commit a crime and expect that to be privileged as a communication, the next point is, as a matter of law, what he was directed to do was not a crime.
That's precisely correct.
And it really is irrelevant whether he was hectoring or badgering or anything else. All we would do is look at the direction that was given to him and decide as a matter of law if that was a direction to commit a crime.
That's absolutely correct. And the point I was trying to make is that if you look at the requested changes, as a matter of law, they cannot amount to a request that he committed a crime.
What did the trial court find? What statute or regulation did the trial court find he had been asked to violate?
I had not seen a specific finding by the trial court in the record concerning a finding for a specific statute.
You said the issue presented to the jury assumed the violation.
It assumed that, in fact, he was fired solely for committing a wrongful act. The argument on the directed verdict in the statement of facts is not completely recorded. And I have not seen the ruling. I have seen the order of the trial court announcing that the directed verdict, motion for directed verdict, was overruled, but no reason to state. I don't know what statute the trial court had in mind for taking the violation of the criminal law might be on the case. And I don't believe that's in the record.
What is the answer to the argument that this was admissible under 503 and 1.04?
Your Honor,
5.
In the first place, I think the disciplinary rule that was in effect at the time the report changes were requested, back in 1984, is the disciplinary rule that ought to govern Mr. Willie's conduct. And I think that's the operative time. And we argued in the briefs also that at least when he filed his cause of action, the disciplinary rule in effect at that time should control whether or not he was violating his ethical obligations in order to do so.
But wasn't 503 alive at that time also?
503 was in effect at that time, and that is the rule of evidence. I think, however, that if you look at the comments to Rule 503, Exception C3, which is the breach of duty exception that Mr. Maness was referring to, if you look at the comment to that provision, it says, the exception is required by considerations of fairness and policy when questions arise out of dealings between attorney and client, as in cases of controversy over attorney's fees, claims of inadequacy of representation, or charges of professional misconduct. That rationale for the exception is the same rationale that applies under the disciplinary rules, and it is no broader. And I think to try and read the text of the rule to create a broader exception, particularly under the facts of this case, is going to be extraordinarily destructive. Let me explain what I mean by that. Any in-house lawyer who advises his client in any area of the substantive law that is enforced by criminal provision is going to have a basis if he argues that refuses to follow his advice or orders that he change that advice or in effect orders for him to somehow assume criminal liability because the area is regulated by criminal laws. Any lawyer who advises his client internally on compliance with the antitrust laws, for example, whether or not the client can make an acquisition or set a price or enter a joint venture, or advises his client in matters of trade overseas, an area that's regulated by the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or advises his client in connection with compliance with the environmental laws, or OSHA, or any other of the myriad various federal legislation that are regulated by criminal statute. If this court holds that because of Rule 503, if his advice is not followed in an area that depends on criminal liability, has a cause of action under Sabine Pilot and can claim that he was terminated because his advice wasn't followed, is going to be able to hold his employer hostage to threat to breach the privilege and to haul his employer into court anytime he's disaffected or feels like his advice isn't being sufficiently followed. The tort, if applied on these facts, would become so nebulous that I think it would truly erode to the point of evaporation the protection of confidentiality for internal attorney-client communication.
Aren't there middle grounds between, as
the attorney has no remedy at all versus a client has no hope of any confidentiality. In other words, when we deal with trade secrets, we have a fairly rigorous procedure for a trial judge to examine in camera and take whatever time's needed to, and get whatever law briefing help is needed to make a decision about whether it's a trade secret or not. Couldn't a trial judge be trusted to undertake the same kind of rigor to decide whether or not a communication does involve a crime?
Your Honor, I think there is a middle way. I mentioned to Justice Abbott before that, you know, we initially argued that the court simply should not be extended at all to the attorney-client relationship, but a more moderate approach is the one that was adopted by the Supreme Court of California in 1994 in the General Dynamics case, in which the court held that they were going to allow attorneys to proceed as long as it was clear that privileged communications were not going to have to be divulged. They were going to let them get into court, but at some point they were going to severely scrutinize whether their claims could be proved without breaching the privilege. And if they had to breach the privilege, and they didn't have an exception under the disciplinary rules that would permit them to do so, then they were simply not going to be given cause of action in court, which they could pursue. And I think that is sort of a middle ground between saying you have no cause of action at all and saying Rule 503 governs. If you read 503 literally, the way Mr. Manis would read it, when it says if there's a breach of duty, there's no privilege, that means if you read that literally and you don't look at the context it's supposed to apply to, that any time in-house counsel goes to court and files a petition claiming a breach of duty, a privilege is gone. Because there's a breach of duty, it's alleged. And I really think that destroys the privilege in this context. So that cannot be the way Rule 503 should be applied. It would be enormously bad public policy, and I think it would be bad law. But there is a middle ground, and I think General Dynamics represents that. If, in fact, you decide that the tort of wrongful termination should be extended to the attorney-client relationship. And it appears to be, perhaps, it's hard to say because there are only a handful of cases that have been decided.
You keep saying extend the tort. What you really mean is if we decide not to restrict a certain occupation, we'll cover it.
Well, a Sabine pilot involved the guy who was just jumping into the water and was ordered to do so in spite of the fact that...
It's still a job.
It's still a job, no question about it. I guess I'm saying it would be an extension because of what the federal court in Willie versus Coastal decided in this case back, I believe it was in 1986, when Judge Hittner looked at this case when it was originally filed, and he said, trying to predict what Texas would do, that he didn't think that this court would extend the Sabine pilot tort to apply to the attorney-client relationship. And he held that as a matter of law, there simply was no cause of action in tort because the attorney's remedies are defined by the Code of Professional Responsibility, and if he is ordered to commit an illegal act, he withdraws from the representation. And it may be that this is a hard choice or that there are some hard economic consequences
for
the
taxpayer. There could be another middle ground. There could be a determination up front if, by the court, whether or not there has been an order to commit a crime before you get beyond what the nature of the communications were. For example, the judge here could have been presented with the statutes that the argument is the crime would have been committed had certain conduct occurred and decide whether or not that would be a violation of the statute. I mean, that could happen.
You're absolutely right. There are a number of middle approaches this court could take beyond simply saying that we're not going to extend the court or, and just as Phillips phrased it, to restrict the court so that it doesn't apply to the attorney-client relationship. There are middle grounds that can be followed, but I think the general trend and the better rule, and if you will look at General Dynamics and look at the cases that have followed it, particularly the Massachusetts case of GTE Products Corporation versus Stewart, it's also cited in the briefs, the general rule that the courts seem to be taking when they're adopting the middle ground is to say that a claim for wrongful discharge can be brought if it's based on a fundamental public policy exception to the employment at will doctrine, but that's only if there is no violation of the obligation to preserve client confidences and secrets is required to prove the cause of action.
Any other questions?
Just one. Petitioner says in their brief that they claim the support of virtually all scholarly commentary, and I don't find a response to that in your briefing. In a supplemental brief, would you address that claim? It's on page 20 of their petition.
Your Honor, we will be happy to submit a supplemental brief on that. When would you like to call us?
When you can get to it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Despite my profound disagreement with Justice Antonin Scalia on virtually every issue that comes before the Supreme Court, I think he's exactly correct when he suggests that as lawyers and judges, we have to rely principally on the plain meaning of language to do our job.
Before you get into that, let me ask you a few more questions about the violation of the law.
Certainly.
It's my understanding that it's Mr. Miller's position that some facilities were in violation. There have been violations of the federal environmental statute.
That's correct. Three different.
And so, in assuming that there's an obligation under these statutes to report non-compliance, why isn't every lawyer, whether you're in-house counsel or outside counsel, who comes upon knowledge that their clients are not in compliance, are they obligated immediately to report that to the federal authorities?
They're certainly obligated to seek immediate correction of the problem. Dual obligation.
They tell their client to correct it, but are they obligated to report to the federal authorities if their client is not in compliance?
Yes, in the event that the status of non-compliance violates the law, certainly. In the same sense that as a lawyer, if I worked for a bank and I found out the president was a bedlam, I'd be obligated to go to the district attorney. You bet. Absolutely.
What if you found out that your client had committed a murder? Are you obligated to report that?
That's a single discrete act that occurs in the past. We're talking here about an ongoing criminal activity. If the activity has consequences for the future, for example, the spill of crude in Biscayne Bay, if you kill all the wildlife there, yes, I have an obligation.
And what was it exactly that happened here that you say would be a crime if Mr. Willis had done what was asked?
I think the best way to describe it, Your Honor, is to say your Court of Appeals decision by Justice Mandel accurately summarizes the evidence supported Willie's claim with respect to the Derby Corpus Christi and Belcher facilities. The best way to say it is, this isn't exactly a case where we claim that Willie was fired for refusing to modify or change the Belcher report. There was an ongoing sequence of events to which Willie testified extensively, which involved a number of different documents and pieces of evidence. The most significant thing here is that there are all kinds of ways to assure that there's no irresponsible breach of the attorney-client relationship by a dissatisfied attorney. And in fact, Judge Davidson followed most of those. This case came before this court once before, a coastal application for mandamus to try to seek prevention of disclosure.
What are these protections?
Well, among other things, what happened here? There was an order directing discovery, but under a strict obligation of confidentiality that the documents would not be publicly disclosed. There's a motion for summary judgment. In fact, there is no factual basis for the claim under this court to revise summary judgment procedures. Cases that involve true bad faith can be easily disposed of without any disclosure of evidence at all. But it seems to me that the most important thing here is if you read the rule 503, the rule says there is no privilege to begin with. And how in the world can we say basically we've adopted a rule that we're now not prepared to follow that clearly allows the admission of evidence? Most of Coastal's arguments are basically, as I understand it, arguments for either repeal a 503 D3 or for substantially modifying it. And I'm not prepared to agree that that's the way this court ought to rule about it. By the way, I don't think any other issues before the court that counsel has suggested. The court can only decide the cases that be granted writ of error.
They won in the Court of Appeals. They were obliged to raise points of error.
Pardon?
They won in the Court of Appeals.
They did indeed, and they won.
And we could uphold it on a different basis.
On any basis that the Court of Appeals did. The point is, the Court of Appeals has never ruled on that issue.
Manus, how about Coastal's argument that Wiley here was fired not because of any allegations that he refused to engage in falsifying reports and high criminal activity, but he was fired simply because he lied. He lied talking to the CWR, and he was incapable of getting along with others.
And the jury rejected that argument. Same argument for the jury. 10 of 12 citizens of Harris County, Texas, said no doctor. That's a pretextual argument that's designed to cover up or conceal the real reason for the crime. That's our we asked the court to follow the rules. Remand the case to the Court of Appeals for consideration of the remaining issues raised by courts.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.